Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The Kansas City media were under the gun all year. The stories from 2014 included the Jewish Community Center shootings, the battle over gay marriage in Kansas and Missouri, the races for governor and U.S. Senate in Kansas, the Royals in the World Series for the first time since 1985, and did I mention a little issue named Ferguson? So many big stories, so much room for error. Today we'll run down the media's performance and consider our panel's picks for the most overreported story of the year and the most underreported story so far in 2014. The media critics today are Pam Fine. She's the Knight Chair for News, Leadership, and Community and a professor of journalism at the University of Kansas. Pam, always good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve.
Derek Donovan is the Kansas City Star's public editor and ombudsman. Derek, good morning to you.
Hi, Steve.
Donna Vestal is the director of content strategy at KCUR and the supervising editor of Harvest Public Media. Donna, welcome to you, too.
Thanks for having me.
So, Donna, this strikes me as a heavier-than-usual year of news, especially with Ferguson and the Royals thrown into the mix. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was a little crazy. Here at KCUR,
yes,
we're expanding. You know,
yes.
We have more reporters than we've had before, and so we had a lot of choices to make in terms of how to cover. I think we especially struggled a little bit when it came to the Ferguson story. For one thing, it's right across the state.
Yes.
We have our friends at St. Louis Public Radio, and we had great reporting coming out of there. So we really had to balance what could we bring to that story here in Kansas City, and when was it time for us to jump in? When was it time to localize that? How could we connect with our own community and not come up as, you know, kind of patting Kansas City on the back? We've talked about that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, there are real issues underlying this, as we've seen, as the whole racial tension has expanded across the country.
Yeah.
It come to light.
Derek Donovan, I suspect that the Kansas City Star, my sense was the Star struggled with some of the same issues that Donna just outlined when it came to Ferguson as well.
No question. You know, one of the fundamental things that editors always have to decide is whether we are going to try to own a story or not. And you've got something that's going on in Ferguson.
Well, what does that mean, own a story?
How many of your resources you're going to devote towards trying to be maybe the dominant force, or certainly if you're going to say we're going to devote a very significant amount of our resources towards this story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very real decision that's made every single day on every single story. Do we want to put this reporter on this story for 2 hours, or do we want to detach somebody and maybe send her over to Ferguson and have her spend a week there? And so there's a lot of different considerations with that sort of thing. And again, it's sort of in the Star's backyard, but not exactly. And there's a lot of great journalism that is coming out of native St. Louis sources.
Mm-hmm.
So editors just have to sort of weigh the cost benefit there about what's really going to do the best for the Star's readers. And also you have to ask, are there other places to get this content?
Yeah.
And of course, the answer there is without question.
Pam Fine, you're a former managing editor. What would you have done if you were running a newspaper in western Missouri, the big stories in eastern Missouri? How do you sort of weigh how much resource you're going to put into a story like that when it's 250 miles away, 200 miles away like that?
I think you put a lot of effort into it because it's a national story and a local story. And as the Star and KCUR executed, there are numerous local angles, and so that story is really a universal story. It's not just a story of a police shooting and a one-time situation, but it's really a much deeper story about how the justice system works, how the racial divide persists, and so that's a story that's meaningful to your community, whether you live right there or you're several hundred miles away.
So would you have sent reporters across the state, or would you have sort of focused more locally on just the issues you outlined there?
I think it's a both and. I think you do want to cover the major elements of the case, and if that means being there, then so be it. I think being on the ground really helps. And, you know, your readers expect when you're a major source of news that you're not just going to rely on other news media to cover the major moments in a large story. But at the same time, I think relating that story to your community and providing additional perspective on key issues is an important role. And certainly we've seen these two news organizations provide that.
You know, Donna Vestal, we're sitting here talking about Ferguson this morning. And I'm wondering, was that the most challenging story of the year for journalists, at least in our neck of the woods, or were there others that maybe rose beyond that?
I do think it was. Ferguson, to me, posed the greatest challenge, is that very question about sending people on the spot. And I think the media became part of the story.
Yeah.
And so that made it even more difficult, because you really have questions about how far do we push this discussion and make, you know, put people in front of the, you know, the part of the issue going on was people trying to get that attention in front and make it as dynamic, and they have issues behind what they're doing. And of course, I'm talking a little bit about the looting and some of the protests that went very far. So when people are protesting, they're wanting media attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so how to gauge, you know, when the coverage is appropriate, not as a question. Now, we also have to balance what the national NPR is reporting with what we're presenting. So we are trying to not overdo it, but to really balance that and connect it to the community, as Pam said. I also think that we were really challenged this year on one of maybe a less reported story, is more the economic changes in the country, the questions over the minimum wage, the question over the income divide in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we've done a very good
That's
job.
That's a hard story to cover,
it
isn't it? The income disparity between the rich and the poor, the 1% and the have-nots and everything else.
Yeah,
and,
but I think that's underlying a lot of what we're seeing happening in the country. And I think we're really called to understand that issue and figure out a way that connects everyone. And of course, I'm a former business editor too, so I have an inclination toward it. I have my own biases, yes. So those are the things that really stood out for me, but absolutely Ferguson, and I think that will continue to challenge us, that story and the growing tension in the country.
Absolutely Ferguson, in your mind, Derek, as the toughest story of the year for journalists?
It's tough in a lot of ways. Part of the problem with Ferguson is it has spiraled into so many different sort of quasi-related topics, and you've got so many things that really aren't necessarily part of what happened in Ferguson, but there's no question that they're related. And I don't know if that's a little too broad. But, you know, at its heart, the biggest issue, I think, for journalists with Ferguson is talking about the concept of community policing and how a police department needs to serve its constituency, because that's really what is at the core of this matter here. And one of the things you could look at locally is a lot of people, a lot of outside observers say that Kansas City, Missouri's police department with Chief Forte has really addressed a lot of these underlying issues with policing its community that do not appear to have been addressed properly in Ferguson before the whole thing went down with Michael Brown.
That guy just impresses me, Chief Daryl Forte, in terms of how he's approached his job and his community outreach. Just what you said there, I just find him to be an impressive guy.
And this is also what's at the heart of the recent case in Staten Island, where the man was choked by a police department or by a police officer. These are the matters of public policy that I think journalists really need to focus on in these discussions. And then you've got these things like, for example, the protests that then spiraled completely out of control and turned into riots. These things are related in a lot of ways, but for example, it's a real disservice to the sincere protesters who are out trying to work for justice to then conflate them with what the rioters did. And so I think journalists need to be very careful about mixing these things up and explaining what exactly
you had
went
a on. Sense watching that story unfold, Derek, that reporters and commentators began to view the protesters differently as the story evolved. You know, at first they were, I'm not sure how to characterize it, but they were, you know, on the streets and maybe causing trouble. And then later there was this sense that they were sincerely offering another point of view that needed to be taken seriously. And you got a sense that the way the media talked about those folks at that point, that the language changed, the level of respect maybe changed a little bit.
And part of that also has to just do with having an open line of communication between the journalists and the people that they're covering. And when you're in the thick of it, especially that first night, that. If those of you who are watching it on TV or watching it unfold on Twitter, things got out of control very, very quickly. And so bringing some kind of perspective to that is very difficult as the news is unfolding.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the things that continuing with the coverage is really important.
Pam, this notion that Derek just mentioned, that there was the events in Ferguson and then these ancillary events that triggered these stories, other public policy stories about what happened in Ferguson and why. How good of a job did the media, just in general, writ large, 10,000-foot view here, what kind of job did the media do in terms of covering the broader story and its implications when it comes to Ferguson?
I think it's an ongoing story.
Yes.
And an important story. And Donna mentioned racial or economic inequality, and Derek mentioned issues of community policing. I think fundamentally there's an issue of distrust in the Black community of our justice system. And I think the across the board, the news media has tried to bring these issues to light. I think the Eric Gardner case in New York and the shooting of the 12-year-old child by police recently has made white America more sensitized to the way that Black communities view police and the justice system.
I think that's so true. And that's the upside from all of this tumult, is this notion that I think a lot of us feel differently and think differently about a lot of these issues now.
Absolutely.
And you think so, too.
Yes.
Yeah. This notion, Derek, you mentioned that the media became part of the story in Ferguson at one point. How big of an issue was that? I mean, too many reporters on the ground, did they get in the way? Did they interfere with the events as they were sort of transpiring over there?
You know, I was not in Ferguson to actually see what the ratio was like. But, you know, a lot of media watchdogs through the years have taken photos of the journalists that are around various types of protests. And, you know, there are some times when certainly you could say that the media is overrepresented. Here in Kansas City, we had an issue where there was a protest on the Country Club Plaza about Ferguson, where a Kansas City Star photographer stepped out into the street and did not hear the police telling her to get out of the street, and they arrested her that night.
Yeah.
It ended up in a story on the front page of the paper, and many readers thought that that was overly dramatic to do a story on A1, because this is the salient issue. She was not arrested because she was taking photos. She was arrested because she wasn't obeying the police orders to get out of the street itself. So a lot of readers gave flack to the Star for that, and you know, rightly so. I think that you could easily argue that it was overplayed.
Let me get our listeners involved here. We're talking about the journalistic coverage of Ferguson. How well do you think the media did, at least from your vantage point? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here again. 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Pam, again, as a former managing editor at the Indianapolis Star and a former managing editor and vice president of the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, which story this year made you wish you were back in the newsroom again?
That's a good question. I have to confess to you that there was no one episode that made me want to be in the newsroom.
Oh, come on. You missed being out there. I know
you. I'll tell you a story listeners may not be as aware of, is sexual assaults on college campuses. And so I've gotten my fix this year by working with University of Kansas journalism students on covering the sexual assault problem at KU and beyond. There was a story in the Huffington Post at the beginning of the semester about a young man who was made to write a paper when he acknowledged to officials that he sexually assaulted a female student. And so his punishment was not even to do community service or expulsion, but to write a paper. And when that story came out, the campus erupted in anger.
Yeah.
And it's come out that here and, of course, across the country, there's a real problem with sexual assaults. So I've been working with students to cover that that, and that has given me my fix this year.
Yeah, so that's where you got it. You know, it's interesting. You know, Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill really catapulted that issue onto the national scene, the national dialogue. And sometimes people say, well, Congress doesn't do anything anymore. Well, there's an example of someone taking an issue and just making it something else entirely. Donna, how about you in terms of, was there a story you wish you could have been out covering yourself?
Well, I think the whole gay marriage issue was one that I think there's so much more to tell beyond. We got so caught up in the legal and the politics of this. I think there are real people and a real general change in perception and acceptance, we hope, in the United States and in our community at large. And I think there are huge stories there to tell, but we've been very caught up in that part of the story. So I'm hopeful that the stories we'll be telling in 2015 regarding gay marriage and gay rights will be much stronger and more addressing the social and economic changes coming.
You know, the story I'd like to read is how is it that that story caught fire, that issue caught fire and sort of swept the country in the way that it did? I'm not sure we've had an author on here talking about that, but journalistically, I haven't seen a hard look at that.
Right, and
I
think overall we always heard this day was going to come. There was a tipping point where it would just be the accepted with most of the American population. And I think we've reached that point. And that kind of changes America, and it changes it just is a huge change, and we have a lot of work to do there to understand this.
Derek, was there a story you wish you could have gotten out and covered?
You know, it's an ongoing story. It's very hard to reduce it to a single topic, but I am continually fascinated by the transformation of Kansas City, Missouri's downtown. And now that the streetcar project's going in, and it's, of course, immensely disruptive right now while it's happening, but a way that you could throw your arms around looking at what that downtown was like 15 years ago versus what it's like today with the very high occupancy rates of residents down there and what that really means to a city's character, because Kansas City, like many cities of its size, has gone through a similar ebb and flow through the years. And I really would love to see somebody able to document that and try to quantify it in some way. That's because that does have a lot to do with the town's sense of civic pride and just what it means to be a Kansas Cityan.
We're talking with our media critics about the big stories of 2014. We're also asking our listeners, how well did the media cover the ongoing crisis over in Ferguson? A very tough issue, lots of facets to it. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Jeff from Blue Springs, you're on Up to Date. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to say that I thought that the media and journalism coverage of Ferguson left a lot to be desired, because initially there was a move in the media, and I don't think it was on purpose, but they picked up a specific bias, and it was not I'm not saying it was a bias of black versus white, but it was a bias of some of the writers and reporters who were covering the story to say that the person was it was written or spoken in such a way that it was indicating innocence or guilt, whether it be Michael Brown or the officer involved. And unfortunately, the readers were and the listeners were, you know, because they were not there, they were relying on the media to give them the information so they could make up their own mind. Unfortunately, a lot of it was opinion more than it was the actual facts surrounding it. And it got spun in such a way that when the truth or information actually came out that disagreed with what people had been saying or the media had been saying all along, then it caused things to just blow completely out of control. And
Jeff, you're talking specifically about who was more culpable here, Michael Brown or Darren Wilson. Am I hearing you right?
Well, I'm not really sure that was – yeah, I mean, I suppose it was initially, you know, that's the way it was kind of talked about in the media. You know, was the police officer right or wrong, or was the Michael Brown right or wrong? And instead of talking about necessarily the facts in the – in the case that they focus on whatever a specific person's viewpoint is.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, it goes in a specific direction instead of people being able to make up their own mind based on the facts. And we're seeing that really in a lot of these news stories all around the United States. I mean,
Let me get some reactions from our good panelists here. Derek Donovan, this bias that our caller Jeff is talking about, did you see it too?
Well, it's certainly difficult for anybody to argue that the punditry doesn't sort of bleed over in people's perceptions of what the media coverage is like. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of alternative media sources out there these days where those lines are not – they're blurred up intentionally. They're not even maintaining them. With any type of pretense that they're trying to be fair about it. Mm-hmm. And so many, many people get their news from those types of sources these days. And there is no question that this is the type of story where a lot of people's immediate reaction is to find a good guy and a bad guy. Well, particularly in this case, there are no clear good guys and bad guys. You know, you don't want to pin your hat too much to either one of the main figures in this because there are a lot of shades of gray in what went down there. And also, again, what we think we know about went down there, which is piecing together these bits of information that came out of the grand jury documents.
You know, that's such an interesting point, Pam Fine, that Derek just made, this notion that the media is always out to sort of say this person's right, this person's wrong, good, bad. The media does sort of go there a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think in an effort to simplify,
yes.
we become simplistic. And
great
we're
line.
Trying
great
to
line.
To get answers, and we may come to conclusions too quickly.
Yeah, and you see that a lot?
You know, I think one of the problems here when a fellow like this makes a comment is that he's so general and broad that it's hard to really figure out whether he's talking about one or two media outlets or the cacophony. I think one of the problems we have is proportionality. I mean, there's so many voices in the news ecosystem today that I never – No, when people say, you know, the media did this, the media did that, whether they're focusing on you know, a particular news organization or a few, or they're just picking up news from everywhere. I think, you know, good news organizations try to get the facts and lay them out and not necessarily reach a conclusion prematurely.
Yeah.
But there's airtime to fill, and there are bloggers, and there's a whole host of people who are trying to, you know, assess and be the person with the right answer. And sometimes, unfortunately, people think they've heard conclusions that are false and sometimes really
yeah.
problematic because they put information out into the public trough that is deleterious.
Donna?
He used the word spin, and that always troubles me when I hear spin. And mm-hmm. I think we have to be
aware.
Because I don't want the media to feel like spin ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a curse word to me, spin. But
yeah,
I
me
do.
Too.
Yeah,
me too.
But we have to understand the audience comes at it from their own view, especially with the Ferguson story and others like it, that they're looking for their own biases. And so what they hear in the media reflects back their biases. And so we as reporters and journalists, it's a very difficult task. Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things that is a little more troublesome about going down that rabbit hole is that we know consumers are getting more and more of their news through social media channels
mm-hmm.
these days. And we all, without necessarily thinking we're doing it, curate our social media feeds to reflect what we already believe. There's not really that many people who genuinely want to be challenged all the time. And so the problem is the more sources you follow on Twitter, the more people you see pop up in your Facebook feed, the more it's going to reinforce whatever that interpretation of the events that you already sort of have in the back of your head.
You know, Mike from Kansas City, Missouri, sort of walking down the road that Derek just trod here too. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. We obviously are getting to a point where the news world is so muddled that it's difficult for people to figure out what is news in the media anymore. Of course, we obviously dropped sort of the red line between, you know, opinion and news some time ago. And And it's getting to the point where the general public really doesn't know who to trust, where to look for news. So is it time, and is there discussion, I'm hoping there's discussion in the industry of journalism, to actually have some sort of accreditation so that a journalist is someone who understands sourcing, who understands how to at least identify bias and how to differentiate those kinds of things. I'd love to hear what the folks think about accreditation and finding a way to separate real journalists, quote unquote, people that we depend on, from people who are basically just in their bedroom sending out messages.
I got you, Mike. Thank you. Pam Fine, you offer us our 10,000-foot views here. What do you make of this?
I think this has been an ongoing discussion and one that people on both sides are serious about, and some people feel that, it, like this gentleman, that it's time to credential or certify journalists, and others who feel that would abrogate our First Amendment, in which every citizen has a right to ask questions and be a journalist, quote unquote. So I think that those of us in the profession do try to distinguish ourselves from others who aren't journalists, and that there is a process that we ascribe to in terms of verification and using multiple sources and trying to provide information that is truthful. You know, there's sort of journalistic professional standards that are employed by mainstream news organizations. I think to go as far as to try to delineate which ones are legitimate and which ones aren't is very tough. I mean, who's to say those people who like to tune into Matt Drudge versus ABC News. Is Matt Drudge any less a journalist than the newscaster on ABC? Some people feel that's the public should decide where it wants to get its news.
I was going to say, Derek, isn't there sort of a consumer accreditation process that's ongoing out there in terms of people go to certain websites that have reputations for journalistic integrity versus those who don't?
Yeah, although part of the problem is in the landscape today, it's very difficult to objectively evaluate those on your own. I mean, Alex Jones has an immense, immense following. And I don't know how many of you are aware of him, but
I'm not.
He's an extremely, extremely conspiracy theory based. I don't even exactly know how to describe him. Kind of a guru, and his stuff is wild. Just you wouldn't believe how wild it is. And he's got millions and millions of followers. And so he's somebody who is clearly just making things up out of whole cloth. Versus somebody like, for example, Matt Drudge, who still remains enormously popular, virtually by doing nothing but hot linking to other sources, most of which are mainstream journalistic sources. It's just his curating of that page is what guides it ideologically. So it's awfully tough, but I don't know what kind of outside certification really is even feasible, because a lot of these bedrock policies are things that professional journalists have already been doing, and it's part of just the mainstream journalism culture out there.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our media critics. And we'll talk about their picks for the most overreported and underreported stories of the year, as well as the story of 2014. We'll also talk about how the media managed to cover the Royals and their historic playoff run. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're talking with our media critics. They are Pam Fine from KU, Derek Donovan from the Kansas City Star, Donna Vestal from KCUR. We're talking about the big stories of 2014. We'll be interested in knowing your recommendations, your nominations for the most overreported and underreported stories of 2014, as well as the big story, the story of 2014. You can submit your nominations right now. Just call 816- 235-2888, or again, tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, people might think, Derek, that the playoff run for the Royals was interesting, but what struck me about it as a reporter was just how long it went and how the newspaper and the TV stations and this radio station were struggling to come up with new angles when those angles appeared to be utterly exhausted after a while. Am I right about that?
Well, I got to tell you, the playoff run has been unprecedented at the Star for a lot of different reasons, because we're in such a different media landscape today than we were in 85 the last time, you know, that they were there. I'll tell you, though, we've got real-time analytics now where we can see exactly how popular this coverage is. And we might think that we're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel, but it just blew the doors off. You know, yeah. It was amazing how much interest there was in not only online, but also I don't know if you've looked around Twitter and seen how many people kept all those front pages and papered their walls and their houses with them. There's a real connection in this community to this team. And, you know, it was kind of a organic groundswell, I think.
How tough was it for KCUR, Donna, to sort of keep coming up with fresh Royals angles?
Yeah, it was tough for a lot of reasons. We didn't really know if we had an audience because everybody was listening to
Good sports point. Talk.
So, but we still were at it because we were having a great time. We were into the story. I mean, one of the first really interesting angles we took was being there at the Star, and we covered the creation of the – I think it was the night they won the division. I think we were there, and Sylvia Maria Gross did some great reporting.
Watching
how the paper and the headline. Oh my goodness, having all those headlines. And I remember when we didn't get into the story until it was much bigger, you know, but the Star was right away, you know, with the initial game playoff and even getting in the playoffs. And I just didn't know how you were going to outdo yourselves with those headlines. And I personally, at the very beginning, I was like, oh, this is overplayed. Oh my gosh. You know, the Royals, I didn't believe. I was not a believer, I guess. And I think that's why it made it such a fun story, because it kept improving and growing. And I got to know the team. And I didn't know the team. And so I was amazed at what it brought to the community. And I think that's what we tried to cover. We weren't covering the ins and outs of baseball or this and that. But we were right there with the community outside the ballpark, not inside the ballpark too much. And then, you know, we just had a lot of fun. And it brought even our newsroom together, because it was something we could all find a place to do something a little different. And it was a challenge, as you say, trying to find a way to cover this. You know, we could reach out to St. Louis, ask questions about what they did in prior years, but they weren't with us this year. Yeah. We also have a public insight network, which we call Tell KC, and I reached out to people from all across the country about being fans of the Royals in faraway places, and that was a real fun thing for us to do that was a little different. So,
you know, Pam, it struck me that, you know, in the media's coverage of a story like that, there's this line that the media sort of has to follow. I mean, it's okay to show some home team pride, but you sort of can't go overboard.
Well, I used to tell people in the newsroom, you can be for two things: democracy and your hometown team. So, you know, I think it's hard to cross a line when it comes to a story like this.
Yeah, exactly.
And you also have to remember, you know, if you're looking at the Stars coverage, there were some games that during that series that I'm sure the Royals would have been very happy not to have seen on A1. I remember in particular the one blowout in San Francisco, and the headline was Frisco Melt. You know, it was a terrible game, but it still was the poster page the next day.
Yeah.
And I will say that this kind of story is great for revenue. I was at a couple of papers, Atlanta and Minneapolis, in which, like elections for TV stations, good news from your local sports teams allow you to do special sections and sell all kinds of products that you might not otherwise get a chance to sell. So it put a few bucks into the coffers of the Kansas City Star, I'm sure.
You know, a very different story. The shootings at the Jewish Community Center posed all kinds of other kinds of challenges in terms of the initial confusion that engulfed the community once shots rang out there, and who exactly Glenn Frazier Cross, the shooter, really was. Derek, I know you had to deal with a lot of that yourself.
And it was a troubling story for readers because, obviously, significant news. As a matter of fact, not long after it happened, I happened to have been in New York City attending a wedding, and all anybody from New York wanted to talk about when they found out I was from the Kansas City area were these shootings. These were things that reverberated across, you know, the entire nation and went international as well. At the same time, it's very troubling for many people to read anything about Miller himself, Cross Miller. He goes by several different names.
Yes, right.
Because his ideology is so disturbing, and they just don't want to invite that into their brains. Yet at the same time, it's crucial in understanding the story. So I understand people in particular who hate to see a picture of him and mm-hmm. who just don't want to relive the particulars of it. That is one of those lines that are really difficult to navigate.
How did you handle that at KCUR, Donna?
Well, you know, we had Frank Morris go down to really understand the roots of this kind of hate and the communities that kind of fester this down in Arkansas, in this case, I think Missouri as well.
Yeah.
So we had some really strong national reporting on that. I do think if I were to say one of my most underreported stories is probably hate crimes and what we're seeing in Kansas City, you know, following up on JCC. It is a hard story to get after, and you're right. A lot of people don't want to hear it. But I think we've got some issues with other things in the Deontay Green story and some other, the Somali team. We've got a little bit of a narrative here, and we're trying to get at that and that impact of hate and hate crimes.
Florence from Kansas City, Missouri. Florence, you're on Up to Date with our media critics. Good morning.
Good morning, media critics. I have a question. Were there any local or national government censoring influence issues on journalists and their news entities this past year, or political influences?
Any censoring out there? Panelists, anybody?
Well, I think there are quite a number of stories related to federal government efforts to prosecute journalists. And James Risen case at the New York Times, who wrote a book using information from CIA sources, and the government wanted him to testify against that source, and he refused. And those Eric Holder just dropped that effort. But that would be one of my underreported stories, the whole effort by the government to keep information from journalists and the public, and also to prosecute government whistleblowers and federal officials who are sources for the news media.
Let's go to some calls again. Cecilia from Raytown, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Cecilia.
I thought I was just calling in with my comment. But I wanted to talk about the most overreported and underreported. I teach at one of the colleges in the area, and I was talking with my students about Ferguson. And just, you know, kind of trying to get some feedback from them. And, you know, they were saying, yes, it was. It was just always in the news and always on social media, and and I agree with them. It was too much. It blew it up. And I'm sorry, I didn't listen to the early part of the program, so I may be repeating what other people are saying. And as far as underreported,
yes.
I feel like Troost has, you know, taken a hit for so long, and now they're starting to be more positive. But still, that East Side, West Side thing, I think, is in the mind of people.
Yeah.
And I've lived in the Kansas City area, you know, for quite a number of years. But I personally am involved with some of the work that's going on at 31st and Troost. And so I drive there, you know, every week and several times a week, and I see those changes. So that would be my point. Let's do more to heal and mend our city,
right,
and less to, you know, bring light to areas where they need healing and mending.
Cecilia, thank you. And, you know, Donna, the whole notion of coverage of truce has certainly been on the minds of our newsroom here at KCUR for quite a while.
It is. Our community engagement team here has helped us launch a reporting project, Beyond Our Borders, where we're looking at the various borders that divide Kansas City. And the first one we tackled was truce. And we've really established a strong body of work talking to people on truce, talking to getting it back at the history of truce, trying to understand how this street and this part of our metro is divided in a very unique way. But the best thing about that is that by being there and committing ourselves to understanding this issue, we have stories and we'll be coming back to truce time and time again, because we have found that the people we're talking to the people there, we're paying attention to it, and we're not going to abandon that. It's not just like a project for us. We understand that this is a crucial reporting venture for us, and we're going to be committed to that. The other lines, we're looking at state line right now. We'll be looking at the Wyandotte and Johnson County line and the Missouri River as a divide. So we have a lot of work to do.
How about a truce for the Kansas City Star, Derek Donovan?
You know, it's a difficult subject to sort of reduce down to just one thing, and that's kind of what you're getting at, Donna, is because in a lot of ways it's an artificial construct,
very much so.
You know, and so breaking that down. But beyond, though, just a pure development aspect of it, you know, you just want to cover the what's going on business-wise, what's going on with the residents in the neighborhood. Of course, KCUR is a little bit uniquely positioned in that you're on Truce.
That's
and,
right.
You know, it's actually part of your own community.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's do this. So we promised our listeners that we would talk about some categories this morning, the most overreported story, the most underreported story. Let's go with the most underreported story, because Cecilia brought up the coverage of Truce as a divide line. I'm wondering, Pam Fine, what did you have for the most underreported story of 2014?
I think going back to something I said a few minutes ago about government efforts to withhold information from the press, we saw a story this morning by an AP writer that had Governor Brownback's administration in Kansas withholding the names of candidates for the county commission in Salina. Voters there a few weeks ago agreed to add a county commission member, and so the governor's office has been vetting candidates for that. It will appoint a member, and they won't release the names of those potential appointees to the news media. In the sexual assault case on campus that I mentioned, it spurred a number of records requests. The university has, you know, released some records, but there are 3 assault cases a week reported to the university. I'd like to see more information forthcoming. So I think government secrecy in general, closed meetings, closed records, that's a very important issue for the state and for the nation, and I'd like to see more vigorous reporting on that subject.
Derek Donovan, the most underreported story of 2014.
You know, this one's a little bit of an evergreen, and some people who have talked to me have heard me say this before, but I really sense that there is something that's almost coming to a head with the amount of just false information about science, and particularly how it relates to nutrition, supplements, that kind of thing. There's been a lot of furor lately about Food Babe. I don't know if you know about her, but she runs a website full of just outright lies where she does her own, quote, research on elements that are in our food and scares people to death. And it's really starting to metastasize, particularly as people share this stuff in social media, where there is almost a badge of pride that some people are wearing to be in possession of all this, quote, secret information about what's in our food that is just not true. And it's always been a problem. You go to any, you know, CrossFit gym trainer or vitamin aisle at a grocery store, and you are having people who are practicing medicine there, in my opinion, giving out this advice that is not based on science.
Yeah.
And I've always been curious as to why the FDA still does not regulate so many of these things. You know, why am I able to go into a vitamin store and purchase extremely high dosage of vitamins that can do really profound things to your body?
Yeah. Donna Vestal, underreported story.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back to U.S. poverty and income inequality. I just really think that that's what we've seen happen in politics this year, budgets and, you know, Obamacare, all of this plays into this issue. And I think we've got a big job ahead of us to cover that. I also, I know you only said one, but Pam brought up the campus rape issues, and we've seen that reverberate across the country. But I think that's that underage drinking or drinking in general and excessive drinking. And I think that that I've heard some really excellent reporting on NPR on that. And I think we need to cover that locally.
Yeah, I picked as the most underreported story, and it's a positive story, which means it doesn't get as much attention in the media, but the stabilizing influence of Kansas City School Superintendent Stephen Green. Mm-hmm. You know, he's more than 2.5 years in after all these years of turmoil and changing out of one superintendent after another. We see some glimmers of hope. It's still early, but we see some glimmers of hope. And my hat's off to Stephen Green for sticking around and maybe charting a new, more stable course here in Kansas City, which if he can pull this off and get this district fully accredited, what a major, major story that's going to be. How about the most overreported story of 2014, Pam Fine?
Well, I've got two. One is the Ray Rice case, domestic violence case. And the other would be Hillary Clinton for president. There's so much conjecture already out there. And that's, you know, all year long, will she run, won't she run? But I'm afraid next year is going to be Hillary Clinton for president year. And not when I say I'm afraid, I'm you know, I hope she runs. I think it'll be interesting. But I just feel like until she decides, you know, it's a lot of conjecture.
Yeah. Derek?
You know, I know what you're going to say, Stephen. I'm going to steal your thunder. But I think that the way so many people, pollsters primarily, got what was going on in Kansas during this election year wrong was a real disservice ultimately to everybody because, you know, obviously they couldn't have called it more inaccurately. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of those polling stories, the people who are reporting them understand what really goes into the polling, but the average person doesn't have much context with that, and they don't understand the way that the wonks who are using the polls really interpret them. And so I think that that whole thing was vastly overblown.
Well, you stole my thunder, unless you buy the theory that the pollsters had it right and that voters at the last minute on Election Day simply changed their collective minds.
Which is possible.
Who knows?
And you would know more about that than I would.
Yeah, who knows? One listener writes us this. The most underreported story in Kansas City was Sprint. Victor writes us this. It seems that every outlet journalist approaches issues with a preconceived notion or has developed a perspective prior to beginning their investigation. Politicians only allow approved questions and journalists don't challenge their tactics. Reporters should investigate local issues, spending, corruption, etc. There's enough to report and investigate without simply following national headlines of what a politician wants us to talk about. That's from Victor writing here this morning. Okay, any response?
Bravo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to Dan from Lenexa. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for the media watchdog. I'm excited to hear that they were on. I feel like national news, the biggest names, CNN, Fox, et cetera, as well as online sources that get a lot of views all over, are reporting more false information just because they don't take the time to make sure their sources are correct.
Right.
And I feel like that's because they're racing to be the first ones to report it when there are so many people now, compared to before the internet, racing to be the first ones to report it. Do you see that issue? And if so, is there any way to actually combat that to try to get more truth out there?
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Derek, you talk a lot about this rush to get stuff first on the net.
And reporters have always wanted to be the ones who got scoops. No, you know, nobody ever wants to be.
Love getting scoops. Loved it.
But one of the most important things you always have to remember is really nobody ultimately usually remembers who got something first,
right.
But they sure remember who got something wrong. And Twitter has exacerbated it to a ridiculous degree. You know, there is almost no way to break news on Twitter these days. And ultimately, who cares if the Star has a story 5 minutes after, you know, KCUR has it? That's not really what's important. And I absolutely think that the rush to get it out there is detrimental to good journalism.
Yeah.
We say that, but, you know, I know how reporters are. And it's a really hard habit to break.
It is.
And it could be our downfall if we're not careful.
Why is being first such a big deal, Pam Fine? Why?
Well, it's about your brand and your reputation.
It's a badge of honor, right?
Pardon me?
It's a badge of honor.
It's a badge of honor, sure. And I guess it started in the newspaper days when there were multiple newspapers in a community, six or seven, and part of the competitive edge was to be first with stuff. And
yeah.
That way you were talked about and you set the agenda and that's, as you said, a badge of honor.
And one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is the concept of news embargoes. Many times a news source will go to a trusted journalist and tell them about, like, for example, if I'm a business owner, a new program that I'm about to introduce. And with the stipulation, you're not going to publish it until whatever time that
yeah.
is. And sometimes they will give this embargoed information to multiple outlets. Well, I have seen many instances, and I think I'm seeing it more often, where some source decides, darn it, I'm going to go ahead and break that embargo.
Yeah.
And so when you see one of your competitors doing that, then you feel, hey, the cat's out of the bag, and so I'm going to go ahead and do it as well.
Donna Vestal, the story of the year for 2014.
Oh, well, Ferguson.
Ferguson?
Yeah.
No question?
Yeah.
Pam Fine? Hard to argue with it.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, Ferguson.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Kansas budget. And that's something that's we're going to see a lot more of over the next few years, how it's rolling out, but Kansas's budget.
Yeah, and I hard to argue with Ferguson. More locally, I picked the reelection of Sam Brownback, despite staggering budget deficits in Kansas. Such an interesting choice the voters made. We'll see how it plays out. And the work of Kansas City Police Chief Daryl Forte and just the dropping violent crime rate in Kansas City, including a big drop in homicides. Kansas City is still one of the most violent cities in America, fifth most violent based on a recent survey for 2013. But 2014 numbers might be a little bit different, and maybe the tide has begun to change a little bit when it comes to violent crime in Kansas City. Well, we're out of time. I want to thank our very good media panel here for coming in today. Pam Fine, the Knight Chair and a journalism professor at the University of Kansas. Derek Donovan, the Kansas City Star's public editor and ombudsman. Donna Vestal, Director of Content Strategy at KCUR and the supervising editor of Harvest Public Media. Happy holidays to all of you, and thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
It's good to have you all.